Thank you, Sheikh Ibrahim, for joining us today. Thank you very much. I have so many Islamic finance questions.
You having balance between your Muslim life and being a lawyer, you're looking at two different worlds.
There's so many different ways to make money, obviously, and there's some that are ethical and some that are unethical. Loaning money to someone and then charging them more than what you gave them in Islam is forbidden.
It's not just forbidden, it's unethical.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the CEO Lawyer Podcast. Today, I'm with my spiritual leader and imam of Roswell Community Masjid, Sheikh Ibrahim. Today, we are going to shake it up, baby, and we're going to talk about entrepreneurship in Islam. This is a topic that I'm specifically interested in, and before we get started, I just wanted to take a few minutes to thank Sheikh Ibrahim for joining us today and giving us the opportunity to use his studio at RCM. And Sheikh, could you introduce yourself and tell everyone about you?
Everyone, obviously, I don't have your level of energy, mashallah. I'm Ibrahim. I work as the imam, the spiritual lead of the masjid, RCM, Roswell Community Masjid, out here in Georgia.
And a little bit of your background. How did you become imam?
By accident.
I don't think so. He's extremely humble. This is something we got to get out of our spiritual leaders, is that they usually have a tremendous amount of knowledge, and they're it's a little guarded and shielded in that regard. But I think it's okay for people to be educated and people to be successful and people to be wealthy. This is okay. This is kind of part of the conversation that we're going to have today. So kind of let us walk us through your background a little bit.
Yeah. So it's funny. You came to my masjid and you're interviewing.
I'm asking you questions because I want to know about you just like you're going to know about me.
Inshallah. So I graduated with a degree in chemistry from UNC Charlotte. And then I went to the University of Medina in Saudi Arabia and graduated with a four-year degree in Islamic law.
Okay.
So it is a law degree.
I did not know that.
Right up your alley.
Let's go. I'll ask you some legal questions then.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
And you're still studying right now too, right?
Yeah. I'm currently doing my master's in Islamic finance.
Okay. I have so many Islamic finance questions, but I know this is a touchy subject because the topic always comes up about riba and interest. And I kind of want to just start there. What is the definition of riba? And just so everyone knows, riba is considered haram, forbidden in Islam. And I've always been a stickler for actual definitions because I think it's important to know what's halal, what's haram, what's forbidden, what's accepted in Islam. So I want to know about riba and whether it's the same or different than interest.
If you're going to do a translation, the closest translation would be usury. So riba is any wealth that is created from an imbalanced transfer of wealth.
Okay.
So there's two types of riba. There's riba that has to do with the transaction, which is when you're trading gold or silver or any other goods, commodities. If they are not in equal amounts and it's imbalanced, so for example, you're trading gold for gold. A long time ago, they used to have gold coins. They're going to buy a gold necklace. That's gold for gold.
Right.
You would have to trade it in equal amounts regardless of the purity. If not, then you're creating an imbalance in the trade. Or in the cases of loans, if you're loaning money and you receive more than what you loaned, you are creating money for money. And so that's what riba is. It goes back to the root word growth. Riba means to grow.
Okay.
So you're artificially growing your wealth from an imbalanced transaction.
And what is the reason that riba or usury is forbidden in Islam?
As a lawyer, right, we're sticklers on words. The reason why it's haram is ultimately because Allah forbade it.
Of course.
The wisdom behind why it's haram is, number one, it increases the gap between rich and poor.
Okay.
It causes a cycle of abuse against people who are in debt. And it goes against the philosophy of the Islamic economic framework. So, for example, in Islam, we do not separate between brotherhood and economics. That's why a lot of transactions can be unethical, because it actually breaches the concept of brotherhood. One example is if I gift you something and you're selling it and I come to buy it from you. You're not going to sell it to me at the same price as someone who's a stranger. So they say this is an unethical transaction. It should be avoided. So we don't separate between brotherhood and economics. Anything that causes shahnat or disputes between people is something that should be avoided, number one. Number two.
And is that partly why there's also the requirement that contracts should also be in writing and there should usually have two witnesses? That's the wisdom behind kind of preventing the disagreements between brothers?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So you're making sure you insulate
the transaction from any potential issues that could arise. Another example with regards to riba
is the philosophy behind loans.
In the capitalist methodology, they see loans as a profit-making opportunity.
Right.
Everything is a profit-making opportunity as far as capitalists is concerned.
Welcome to America.
In Islam,
loans are charitable contracts. They're not profit-based contracts. And so charities are different levels. The highest level is that you give and you don't want anything in return.
Understood.
Lower level than that is that you loan somebody money and it comes at a cost. That's the whole point of a charity, right? Is that you're sacrificing something of yours, of value, so that someone else benefits. You're losing access to your money for a time at the cost of inflation, at the cost of whatever. You're losing it for that time, and then later you get it back. And so, yeah, it's going to be a lesser value, but it's a charitable contribution that you're helping your brother out. And then the third is partnering up and, you know, these partnerships, you know, you invest or something like that, and that you get some profit out of it and the other person can benefit.
So usury, I'd have to look up the Webster's definition, but I think it's just excessive interest. And so the root word of riba being growth, how can you consolidate depreciation of the dollar, inflation of the dollar, and lack of growth when you actually charge someone the same amount, i.e., I give you $100 today, next year that same $100 is actually worth less? Is there any room for interpretation in the religion that it's okay to include that fluctuation of the dollar, depreciation, the loss of the value over time? Or is it hard line rule, this is not taken into consideration because this is a donation, a charitable endeavor versus a profitable endeavor?
Exactly that. So there's no room for it because that's like saying I give charity to make benefit out of it. The whole point of charity, that's why it's alien to the concept. The whole point of charity is that you're giving so that someone else can benefit, right? I'm not giving for my own benefit. We call that showing off or riyadh in Arabic. Or for example, it's like ulterior motives. If I give someone charity, but he has to do me a favor later, like that's not pure charity. Don't follow your charity with favors and harm, right? So you give and you forget. That's the ultimate version of charity that pretty much everyone agrees on. Loans and duyun are the same concept. You're sacrificing something. You're losing agency over your wealth for a time, and it's going to depreciate, or it could appreciate, you never know. But that doesn't matter. The point is that it's no longer within your grasp, and then someone else just takes it at a later time.
So it seems like, at the very least, charging excessive interest to someone, loaning money to someone, and then charging them more than what you gave them in Islam is forbidden.
It's not just forbidden, it's unethical.
Are there any exceptions? Are there any exceptions to where if someone, or if you were to loan money to someone and you told them, this is going to cost you more than what I'm giving you, is there any exception in Islam for loaning money and charging a sort of interest or fee or getting more than what you gave in the initial transaction?
Not that I know of.
I can't think of something off the top of my head.
Well, because this is just a... Yeah, but this is just the sale. This is just the sale, right? This is the loaner, the one that's actually doing the loan, facilitating the loan. We know that that part of it is haram. Is it the same for the person assuming the loan? Like, you also cannot pay interest?
So, yes, you're not allowed to pay, or so paying for it, loaning it, being a witness over it, writing it, documenting it, all of that is prohibited. And you can compare that to alcohol. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says, cursed is the one who consumes it, cursed is the one who trades it, cursed is the one who witnesses the sale, and cursed is the one who carries it. And so, yeah, our morality or our compass of what we see is right and wrong ultimately is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God, tells us to do or not do. So anything that is forbidden is immoral, and anything that is allowed is moral. So because it's an immoral act, anything to do with it in any capacity is haram. We add a little bit of an asterisk. In today's world, there are certain usurious agreements that if a person is ultimately in need and has no other option, like trying to buy a house or something like that, he's trying to get into a mortgage, there are people that have said, look, it stands as its ruling. It's haram. But in your case,
you need it to survive.
It's kind of, it's equivalent to being in the desert and the only thing to drink is something exactly that's forbidden, or being in a place where you're starving and the only thing that's available to eat is pork.
So it's a temporary license.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's not an exception. It's a temporary.
It's an exemption.
A temporary exemption for your specific circumstance. And so let's talk about those a little bit. And I think you were heading towards home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, especially right now in the U.S., buying a home it's no longer as cheap on a mortgage, on a monthly payment, as it used to be. But for a very long time, it made way more economic sense to just buy a home and have a mortgage. Even though you were paying 3%, 4%, 5%, 6% interest, it was still significantly cheaper than renting. And now, because interest rates have started to go back up, it's kind of like, well, it might make more sense to rent a little bit. But and I'm not saying this is your specific opinion unless you want to go on record for it, but what do scholars in general, what have scholars agreed upon that when purchasing a home as a Muslim has given you a temporary license or exception to the well-known usury rule, which is that you cannot involve any interest in any dealings? What is that temporary exception?
I mean, there's a range. Some, for example, allow it, what's the word, carte blanche, just allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And others say, absolutely no, don't touch it in any capacity whatsoever. Obviously, the more correct out of both of those is the second opinion, which is that this is for sure 100% don't touch. That is the strongest opinion. Now,
and there's room for still being able to buy a home but subhanAllah, if you make the intention, and I've found this in my own life, if you make the room for in your life where anything dealing with alcohol or even remotely close to it, or any events that are involved with it, I'm going to separate myself from it. Anything that involves interest, I'm not going to buy and put my name on something with interest that includes credit card, that includes buying a home. Opportunities will present themselves to owner finance. And what I've done, and I don't know if this is okay, but let's just talk about it. Sometimes you'll find that a home costs, let's say, $300,000, and the owner wants you to buy it $300,000 cash. Well, you don't have $300,000 in cash. But what you can do is offer them owner financing and say, how about you finance it for me and I'll pay you monthly payments? Well, because we're in a capitalist country, they're not going to just give it to you for 0% interest. They'll say, well, I need at least the industry standard of 5% interest. And let's say over the course of 15 years, you end up paying $450,000 for that home. So what I've done in those kinds of situations is just say, how about we agree to a $450,000 purchase price at 0% interest? That way there's no interest in the transaction, but I'm still able to buy this home halal, and it's religiously permissible. Yes, I'm paying a little bit more, but I don't have, any sort of other alternative. Anything wrong with that?
No, because that you're agreeing to a different price. That's all you're doing.
Right.
And, you can pay installments over time. in Islam, and you can increase the price because of the cost that it has on the seller. The thing is, and what you're calling or what you're describing is in Arabic, they call murabaha. Murabaha meaning that I'm selling this plus a percentage over time. Most people don't do that. I don't think anyone does it.
The owner finance deal?
From the Islamic lens, I know that they don't have the overhead or the capital to sustain that.
No, I'm talking about the owner of the home that's selling you the home, sells it to you. That's what owner financing.
So you're the lawyer.
Right.
And you would have
to. Well, you're a lawyer too.
Not an lawyer. I studied law.
Yeah.
But at that point, you'd have to look at what does the law say, if that's allowed. If the law allows it, then that is a valid sale?
No, well, it's 100% valid, for sure. Like, as a contract.
Yeah, as a mortgage, or doesn't
a third party, a bank have to come in?
There's no bank.
So just two individuals?
It's two individuals agreeing to a purchase price set over a specific period of time, written in a contract with two witnesses to make it halal.
Yeah, I mean, if what you're describing is there, then that's fine.
That 100% exists. Yeah, every time you pass by a home that says for sale by owner, that opportunity is available.
I'll keep that in mind for myself.
the thing is, those deals are few and far between because most people that own homes also owe a mortgage. So they're not in a financial position to sell you the home on payments because they actually need the money to put it into a different opportunity. So let's talk a little bit about what some scholars have deemed to be the exception of purchasing a home. I've heard some numbers thrown around like, hey, anything under 8% interest, you know, tawakkal ala Allah. Or if it's your first home and it's your first home and you're using it for your specific purpose and the only other option is for you to rent and it's causing you more harm to continue renting, then Allah does not want that hardship on you. And Islam is a very reasonable religion, so it's not going to impose something on you that is obviously going to harm you. So is that kind of their philosophy behind why they say some scholars will say it's permissible?
Yeah, so but they give conditions.
Okay.
So there like I said, there's a range. Others would default to saying, okay, if you have an Islamic option, go for the Islamic option. What is an Islamic option? An Islamic option today with UIF, Devon Bank, Guidance, or all these other groups, they'll come in and they'll say, okay, we're coming in as a diminishing partnership, right? I'll buy 95%, you buy 5%, and then you buy your shares over time. Whether it's a...
Oh, we're going to talk about that, but go through the rest of the example.
So there's issues with it, and they acknowledge these issues. And then on top of that, I've spoken to other lawyers, and they mentioned how there are statutes in place that even then legally it's still defined as a mortgage. And so it's problematic. And so that has a gray area. Now, if you want to go to a stronger shade of gray, which is personally the opinion that I take, and that is that the person goes for the most secure and most cost, appropriate option that he can afford. Because a lot of those smaller time groups, it's not as secure. They have a bunch of random fees and it's like, it's really hard on people. And even sometimes they end up selling the loan altogether. And if it wasn't a loan to begin with, how can you sell it as a loan?
And they're usually getting their money from banks anyway. They're not getting private equity funds from Muslims.
Like, there's a lot, like I said, it's a gray area. So the way I look at it, I empower the buyer because the buyer is the one in need. When I'm looking at the scope of the transaction, it's the one who needs the house. That's who I'm going to emphasize, number one. And so based off that premise, where does my logic go? Well, how long does it take to usually pay off the interest of a house? 5 to 7 years?
Pay off the interest?
Just the interest. You usually start out with just the interest. It takes about 5 to 7.
You usually continue paying interest all the way through the lifetime of the mortgage. It just decreases.
Okay, let me frame my question differently.
When do you have positive equity? When are you above water?
Depends on the interest rate, but we can call it 5 to 7 years.
On average, out of the 30-year stand, it's usually by the 5th or 6th year, 7th year maybe. And that's when you're above water.
Right, or unless you put a big down payment.
Most people don't. Right. So let's take that 7-year number. Can you buy a house cash within 7 years? If you can, I don't think you should go with the gray area. If you're making enough money buy a house, $400K, $500K within 7 years, just struggle for that specific amount of time and save yourself the issue of even going in the gray area to begin with.
Well, that's hard to predict.
For a bracket of people, a specific bracket.
Right, but isn't it hard to predict whether you'll be able to, because I could probably afford it if I look back retroactively 7 years on today's income. If I had today's income for 7 years, I can afford.
You go based off now.
No, but what I'm saying is if I looked at today's annual income that I have and say, if I do this for the past 7 years, then I can afford today's prices. But if this income remains over the next 7 years, house prices may be significantly higher 7 years from now. You know what I mean? I'm just saying it's hard to predict. And so that's why it's kind of
when you talk to a lawyer.
I'm talking.
You know, looking at that.
it's more of a math issue for me because.
Well, think of it this way. You're in, let's say, Alpharetta, and you're making $200K.
Right.
I would not give the allowance to somebody who's making $200K, or for example, they're both working and they're both making $200K, they're both making $400K a year, just rent for a little bit, for a few years.
Save up some money. Right. And you don't have to go and buy a $2 million home. You can start with a small ranch and work your way up.
Exactly. So the reason why I mentioned the 5 to 7 years is, who am I talking?
Understood.
Now, let's say you can't, which is the majority of people. They're not capable of buying cash 5 to 7 years a house. What do they do? In this case, you go with the most affordable option for you regardless. Right? That's the fifth way that I follow. And so you would look for the lowest interest rate, the most secure option, whether that's Islamic or otherwise. You go for what's best for your family. And so, and a lot of people will end up, they'll get into an interest-based mortgage, and then they'll double down and they'll pay it off within 15 years because they're trying to get out of it.
Right.
And they care heavily about that. They want to hedge, they don't want to live in a house of riba, you know, whatever situation they may be. But they're in need. And there's a principle that we have in Emily, that Allah tasawi, that tasawabat. That the situation, if it becomes easier, then you restrict yourself. But if the situation is restrictive, then the rules of the sharia are easier on the person.
Understood. What is that called again?
It's a maxim. An amru idha dhaqa tasa'a wa idha tasa'a dhaqa.
Which translates?
That if a situation is...
has become easier.
Then you restrict yourself.
Understood.
But if a situation is restrictive, then you take it easier as far as the laws on the individual.
That's the beauty of Islam, that... There's always room to make Islam easy for you if you need it to be. And obviously there are certain things that we know are red lines that you should never do, no matter the circumstances. But, you know, you got a gun to your head and someone is threatening to kill your entire family or do something, you know, ravage the village, pillage the village, and there's exceptions in almost every sort of situation. And, you know, here we're talking about, you don't have a gun to your head. You're just deciding whether you want to pay $2,500 a month in rent or you want a $2,200 mortgage. But it's still...
treat a crisis situation. If it's a crisis situation, which we call a barar, then you have a haja. Haja is like
a need.
We treat a need as if it's a barar.
Understood. So those companies that claim to halalify the contracts for mortgages. Basically what they do is they find Muslims and they market to them and they tell them, hey, Muslim, we got an opportunity for you to buy a home right now. And instead of you paying traditional mortgage and paying the interest rate, what we're going to do is we're going to buy the home for you and then rent it back to you. And you're going to continue having a piece of ownership over time as you pay for this home. The only difference is you don't have the same protections as a mortgage, and you actually pay more than almost every other major bank or financial institution. How is that halal?
Okay, so we have to be fair, because some rates that they have are not necessarily, like, they're not always mortgage friendly. So I've spoken to a few brothers that are involved, and they'll mention how their rates are actually comparable. So case by case scenario, I don't think they're all the same. I think you need to kind of take them each one on its own merit and you know, judge it accordingly.
If you have the option of a Muslim mortgage company, Muslim loan, and an American loan where it's a percentage, and these are the last two companies that you were able to find, and it really just boils down to the Muslim option is just more expensive than the American option. The Muslim option is a halal contract where they basically just restructure the words in the contract, but they charge you a little bit more versus the American traditional mortgage system. In that situation, should you still go for the Muslim contract, even though it's a little more expensive? Or do you go for the one that's actually easier for you and your family?
So I think that is a decision everyone has to make for themselves. If people ask me as an imam, I lay out the opinions and I make sure to tell them, make your own decision. Because maybe I'll give them a fatwa or a directive, and it's really not my place to tell them do this or don't do that. Others, like I know some people that will say, listen, man, I know that I'm paying more. I know that I'm getting fooled, but at the end of the day, I get that assurance that they market it themselves as halal. I'm not a person of finance. So on the day of judgment, and I'm standing before God, I'll say, listen, they told me it was halal. I didn't know any better. I did the best that I could. I couldn't afford buying it cash, and so I went through them. Yes, I'm going to pay more, but at least I have that sense of, you know, personal peace that on the day of judgment, it's like, not my problem. Y'all are the one that told me it's halal. On the flip side, the thing is, they don't have the overhead, but I do think that there should, and I think they're trying. I think they're trying. And there are leading professionals like Sheikh Joe Bradford, Dr. Emmanuel Qudha, and others that are Sheikh Salah Salami. There's all great leading scholars that kind of talk about it more. I think these organizations, to kind of lift the burden off their shoulders, instead of heavily marketing as 100% that they're compliant, Sharia compliant, which is different than saying halal, but they're saying they're Sharia compliant and they're pushing for it and this and that and marketing, and, you know, but then people have bad experiences. You would do yourself a favor by clearing it out and at least, you know, having these honest discussions, these frank discussions with people on what your system is, without being defensive either. If, for example, they're saying, listen, we're going to reword it as a diminishing partnership, which had to come into an episode. And that's the only way that we can frame it without turning it into ribah. That's the only thing that we can do. Fair enough. So then why is your liability 0%, but you own 95% or 90% or whatever amount, and you are not liable for anything, but the miskin was, you know, going your way because he can't afford it, he's 100% liable. Yeah, he lives in it, but you own 90% of it. Right. So answer the questions and be forthcoming and say, you know what? This is the best that we can do. Whether it's statutes that are in place or the market, because I know the housing market is after 2008. They don't have much wiggle room in how they can do things as a seller for housing, you know. And so it really depends. And if they're forthcoming in that regard, and then they come and say, well, listen, this is at the end of the day, a shade of gray. We're not gonna sugarcoat it or try and like weasel out of it. This is what we have. I think that you'll earn more people's trust that way. And they'll be willing to pay the extra dollar, because you're honest with them. And the Prophet ﷺ, he says, the tajir, the seller, who is trustworthy and saduq, he's honest, then they are with the martyrs and the anbiya on the day of judgment. And so you're not hurting yourself by doing that, but when you come to sell something as if it were, you know, some, you know, unicorn, and we all know it doesn't exist, then, you know, so again, Islamic economics, brotherhood. Right, the concept of brotherhood is really important.
I think that's a suitable answer. I want to talk a little bit about insurance. Is there any type of insurance that's haram or forbidden in Islam?
So just a kind of, I'll just preface and say, for more information, check Sheikh Joe Bradford. He's really good on this.
So instead of having a super open, wide, because there's so many different types of insurance, let's start with car insurance. Is car insurance haram?
As a concept, it is haram. Now, you can't have a car without it, so you have to have it.
And so because the exception in Islam is that you have to abide by the law of the land.
Yeah, and you can't live without it. So, you know.
Well, no, in Alabama, you don't need car insurance.
Well,
we're in Georgia, so we're not going
to
get
it's similar to...
It's similar to say, I think in Georgia is different. You're the injury lawyer, right?
No, I gotta make sure that I'm in a halal business. But like, you know, with car insurance,
it's not just the insurance itself. Can a person, it's like medical insurance.
It's not something that the nature of the transaction is not compliant with the ethics and the moral code of our Sharia. It's not Sharia compliant. But can you truly survive without medical insurance? You have a child that's about to be born, right? And then you're going to pay all those costs. You'll go under very quickly. You have a big surgery, you have whatever. It's very costly, so you have to have insurance. It's the same thing with car insurance. You will have insurance, but the other person is insured. I mean, that, like, you're going to have to deal with their insurance company. And then...
And plus, getting pulled over without insurance, now you got to pay for a ticket, and you get your car sewed. And
so it's just in car...
So car insurance, health insurance, you have a buy in Islam to have those.
But the concept of insurance, what is the concept of insurance?
It depends on how you frame what insurance is.
There's different ways that you can approach it. Is insurance you selling?
Right, you're selling assurance. Which is the definition of you're selling peace of mind over a potential thing that could happen to you.
Right. You're paying $200 a month. I got your back. Anything happens to you, I'll take care of it.
Within reason.
With at least. Right. About a specific thing. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that as a transaction, then you would have to open into the Islamic tradition and say, what do the scholars say about this concept called zarar? Zarar is ambiguity. When I'm selling something, I have to be clear of what I'm selling, right? I have to know that the buyer and the seller have to be in complete awareness of the transactions happening. This is a very ambiguous transaction. I am charging you in case something happens. There's no, like, what's being sold and what's being bought here. It's very ambiguous. That's one way to look at it. And so, based on the merit of ambiguity, the scholars, different opinions of scholars that come and look at it differently. Then you have the other way that you can look at it and say, okay, let's say, take car insurance. Person pays a certain premium for his car, okay? $100, $200, whatever it is, right? And the car. You are paying a certain amount in an increment, at the incremental basis, over time. Something happens to that car. The insurance company gives you money in return, right? To fix the car or to trade the car.
Right.
You are giving money for money. Is that an equal amount? Most likely it is not, because these insurance companies have crazy, what is the word?
Guys that study the statistical analysis of it and all that stuff, they know for sure how much they're going to charge you. They're going to make money off of it. So the money for money concept, right? Number one, there is a disparity in the amount of money that's being traded, right? It's not an equal amount. Number two, not all insurances are like this, just to get ahead of the question. The mutual insurance and stuff like that is a different
concept, but just the standard.
And if that's how insurance started.
It is
a mutual.
And it was kind of like everybody kind of getting together, right? We call it Jeremy Yoderd.
Spanish is a thunder.
Sort of like the little village gets around.
Yeah, they
like
all pool in money together. Or like something
$100, and then they actually give all the money that comes up. Like 50 people get in a little group, and every person every month puts in $100, and then all that money goes to one person every single month. And so before you know it, it's like you have an opportunity to make $5,000 as long as you're in that banda. But it's kind of how the evolution of insurance started. Was, well, we put all this money together in the event that someone has a catastrophe and we need to help them. And so what insurance companies realized was that we could just take your money and not give it back to you. It's like, why would I give the money back to you? That's not fun. I'd rather just take it. It's so that's crazy, what insurance companies do.
It's, and then they'll raise the rates if something does happen. It's insane. So to go back to the deficit quickly, and I'm going to get started. But so that's one issue, right? Is that there's a disparity in the amount of money. Remember the definition of money, because the money has to be given in equal amount, right? Otherwise, it is usurious. Okay. There's another thing that has to do with that I didn't mention. The Prophet said that gold is for gold, silver is for silver. That wheat, barley, salt. We bought brothers, hearts, and dates. Four things. And then he says, yadan biyad, mithlan bimit. Right? Hand to hand. When you trade, you're saying, like, I'm giving you something right into your hand. Right? Meaning that the transaction has to happen immediately. Right? And so one of the definitions is, if you're trading gold for gold, money for money, unless you want to give me the whole argument that money is not intrinsically valuable, and so it doesn't qualify as you can't equate it to gold, but let's assume that it is equatable to gold, right? Because the GDP, it goes based off the GDP and not based off the gold standard anymore. But put that on the side. During the insurance process, you are giving the money in increments and not getting the money in return. And so it doubles, it compounds in its usurious nature that it's not given in
immediate transaction.
Because a dollar down...
unequal, but it's also unethical.
So they're charging you more for a service that you don't know if you're going to actually use. And then when you do use it, very rarely are you actually getting what you've already paid into it. And if you get more than what you paid into it, it's also haram.
You are called an anomaly at that point.
Yeah, well, and or a personal injury attorney.
Oh man!
So an example that happened actually in Chicago was, it snowed one time very heavily, right, in a neighborhood, and it actually caused a lot of roofing issues. And people had insurance; they have to have insurance for their homes. So what happens? The insurance company is like, "Oh well, we can't afford this anymore. Right. This is too expensive. Bankrupt. Let's raise the rates."
A lot of them actually go bankrupt.
Or that
in Louisiana with all the hurricanes and Florida recently. They're actually just filing for bankruptcy and shutting down. It's like, well, we've collected all this money from you. Well, now that we actually have to pay, we're just going
to bounce. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, I mean, that's the problem with the capitalist nature. One of the issues with capitalism and
liberal philosophies as a whole. So liberal, I don't mean liberal like in the political sense today. I mean liberal in the sense of philosophical liberalism, which is capitalism, socialism, communism. These are all liberal philosophies. Liberal philosophies are very materialistic. And so their very definition of economics is that you have an unlimited amount of wants and a scarce amount of resources, right? And so because they define it and they frame it in such a way, they want to maximize their profitable potential for every little thing, at any cost, in any way, and they deem it, and they deem that as something that is like, praiseworthy. The Islamic definition is completely opposite, where it says, well, hold on a second. We don't even believe in a scarcity of resources the way you're framing it, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a Razzaq, and He is a Khannab as well. So what is a Razzaq and Khannab? Continuously providing and continuously creating. And so you don't determine how much there is of something, because you don't really know. Right? That's beyond the bounds of your concept of knowledge. We're still learning new things today about our earth and the crust and what's under it and all that stuff, right? We don't know. We can't measure exactly how much there is of anything. Rather, we believe that it is a place from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so we act in an ethical way. We uphold ourselves in a different approach. We don't chase after and hoard and cause all these issues. What's on your friend, brother? I was baffled when I saw it. It's like, apparently it's a YouTube thing where people are like trying to swallow as much food as possible. They're gorging food, and that's like, they're making millions off of it, just like making YouTube videos.
Yeah,
food. But then you have world hunger and you have all the stuff that's happening. How does that make sense?
Right. Let's talk about that.
There's so many different ways to make money, obviously, and there's some that are ethical and some that are unethical, and it could obviously be argued, at least Islamically, that
if the way that you make money is just by eating as much food as possible, you know, like maybe that's not the most ethical way. But what if you're a professional like food connoisseur or food critic, you know, like there's a lot of these, you know, sort of like
Yeah, I mean, everything is halal until proven haram, right? That's the standard.
I like that. So.
But then you look at it and you look at the spirit of it, right? You have your Muslim brothers understood at the end of it. Like that, you have to like consider these things. We put that. That's what Sharia compliance is, by the way. So Sharia compliance is different than saying something is halal.
It's just that the spirit of the transaction,
yeah,
is consistent with Sharia values.
Exactly.
So there's a difference between halal
and Sharia compliant.
Mm-hmm.
Halal is permissible in Islam, and it's clear that it's permissible.
Like drinking water, it's permissible. Drinking alcohol is impermissible. It's forbidden. It's haram. There's exceptions in those situations when it's a catastrophe
or a medical need.
Or an emergency.
Mm.
And similarly, with things that are Islamically permissible, there are also situations where it might be impermissible. Like, you probably shouldn't, you know, drink gallons of water at a time when you know that it could potentially, you know, cause you to drown or die. So even good things could be excessive.
This guy was getting
chicken drums and just like straight up. That's crazy.
But the point is there's a difference between halal and then Sharia compliant and haram, and it's kind of like almost like a teetering balance here. And Sharia compliant is just consistent. The spirit of this transaction or this philosophy is consistent with Sharia values versus this is halal.
Yeah, I mean, you could also like frame it differently to where you say a company that what it is selling is fine, but let's say, for example, it's a copper industry or some kind of raw material, and they are abusing people to get that raw material so that later they sell it. What they're selling is not haram, but the process in which they got it was unethical, and so it, you know, that's where the Sharia compliance comes in as well. You look at governance, you look at, you know, process, you look at, you know, their operations. Put it all together, and then you say, okay, well, you know, they mix a little bit of this and that. Is this something that we deem to be compliant with our moral code or not? And a lot of it is subjective. So you'll have conferences that have different metrics of what is it, what isn't Sharia compliant.
So in Islam, is it looked down upon, or is it encouraged to become wealthy?
It's encouraged.
It's encouraged. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about like Sayyidina Sulaiman, and let's talk about some of the most, you know, influential and successful, wealthy people in history. Why is it that sometimes, you know, we kind of feel like, you know, eat the rich, they shouldn't be wealthy, and what are some things that we could kind of shed light upon to the audience that's listening and watching about why Islam does encourage you to be successful and to be wealthy if God gives you the ability to do so, and how should you treat that wealth?
I mean, so there's ultimately the best reason to become wealthy is that you're a giver, not a taker. And Prophet ﷺ says the stronger Muslim is better than the weaker Muslim. And in all of them, there's good. But a person who is, you know, supporting and helping others, you can compare him to a person that's just like absorbing, right? We want to be givers, not takers. Prophet ﷺ says the higher hand is better than the lower hand. The companions, they came to the Prophet ﷺ and they complained. And they said that the people of wealth have gone away with all of the reward, right? They've taken all the reward. They're giving in charity. They're doing this and that. We're missing out. We don't have the opportunity to do so. So the ultimate maqsad, which is the purpose of making wealth, is not just to be wealthy. It's to contribute. Prophet ﷺ was with his companions, one of them got ill. And so he wanted to give away all his wealth and like charity. And so he said, no. Save some for your family. It's better that your family inherits after you and they're wealthy instead of them going around and begging others and helping them or asking for help from them.
And, you know, you want to help
That's to do with, like, goodness to the family, but this one is specifically he wanted to give all his wealth away in charity. He was sick from Hajj and this and that. He wanted to give all his wealth away. He said, no, don't do that. Save some for your family that, you know, you don't want them to sit here and beg others for help. And so this concept of financial independence is important. To be wealthy is important because, and it, you know, it's not just about the charity, but it's also about your capacity of changing the narrative around you. people naturally look to the wealthy for guidance, right?
Yeah.
They look to
that influence.
Because of the influence, that's power. And so as Muslims, we want to be in that position because that's a guidance to others in the proper context, right? When you're rich and wealthy and you are a person of moral character and conduct, look at Hamid Marmagoveda.
Right. Yeah, right now he's a great red apple.
But he's like obedient to his mother, obedient to his father, obedient to his, you know, older brother. He takes care of his family.
And he's created a generation of fighters that are similar.
Exactly. And so that
backs. It's elevated the perspective of Islam because of how he carries
100%.
Himself. 100%. Outside of his financial success and his success in the cage,
he's a successful Muslim because of the positive impact.
Now, let's say he was a nobody. No one's here to care.
But now, all of a sudden, the UFC champion who won 30-0, never lost a round in his whole career,
honestly, he's the GOAT. And it's
John Jones, man, coming in hot.
I give it to Habib, bro. I give it to Habib.
I don't know. I think we just got to get John Jones to become Muslim, and then we'll both be winners on this one.
Inshallah. I mean, he just won recently.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm telling you, like, you know, so if you're a somebody of influence, of power, of wealth, but yeah, at the same time, you were a person of goodness and conduct. That's amazing. Prophet ﷺ was rich before when he was with Khadija radiallahu anha. They were rich.
You know, you mentioned Sulaiman, Dawood ﷺ. Dawood ﷺ used to be a king, and then he would sell iron on the side. He was a smith.
His side hustle.
Yeah, side. That was waste. And so like. You know, it's a matter of the perspective here is you don't want to be a person who's begging others. You want to be a contributor to society. And by being rich, absolutely. You know what? Anyone to be poor. The last one there says, "Kayla yakun adulat bayna al-aghnia minkum." You don't want a disparity between the rich and the poor between you. You want to minimize that gap so that more people are helping. Hence why we give charity. Hence why we give zakat al-mal.
Yeah, mandatory zakat.
Hence why, you know, one of the things that is lost on us here in the States, but it's something that you see in abundance in some countries, and that is trusts, waqf. For example, a hospital that's a waqf, right? For people that are dealing with cancer, there's no charge on people that attend it. It's a communal ownership, right? Places for the orphans, places for women that are being abused, places for, you know, like shelters and whatnot. Even just a garden where people can come and rest and drink from the water, this and that. All of these concepts of communal, you're giving back to the community. Someone is sustaining you and giving it, but everyone else benefits from it. It's lost on us here because we always see something as a potential for making gains, while as in a different world, it's seen as, how can I help everyone else out? You know what I mean?
You know, that's why I want to be rich.
That's really like my... If I were to write down my 20-year goal, the thing that I seek to accomplish in this life is, you know, in a material world, is to build the first Muslim hospital in America that is free for anyone that needs it. And it's the concept of, and my perspective is that Allah has given me the ability to build businesses and to make a lot of money. And I see that as a duty and an obligation to use that for something good, because it's actually not as fun when you become extremely wealthy and you keep it all for yourself. And there's this phrase that I love, which is people that say money doesn't buy happiness haven't given away enough of it. And it's all consistent with Islam, which is in our religion, it's not only allowed, but encouraged to become wealthy as long as you're using it for something good. And there's almost nothing that, even if a catastrophe befalls upon you, but it brings you closer to God, or it has a positive impact on society, then it's not really that, you know, and there's like an example with, you know, my brother-in-law that he recently passed away. He was in Dallas, Texas, Ali Abhamel. And this is a catastrophe, and he lost, he left behind his wife and his two kids, and she was pregnant at the time. But there were over 1,000 people that came to his funeral, and
You know, he was good friends with Imam Musaliman in Dallas. And it at least with me and with some of my other family members, it made us more religious and it made us more appreciative of our family members. And it made us not take things for granted. And I also saw in my mother-in-law how deep her faith was, because this was the third major loss in her family. First, a two-year-old daughter, then her husband, and then her son. And she has deep, deep faith.
Some people are saints. They're untested and tested.
And you know, and it's like, and I get to experience that. And I get to mourn with them, and I get to watch how faith makes you an immovable source for good. And even in catastrophic situations, you can find the good. And we're talking about a good thing, which is making a lot of money, but it could also corrupt you and it could make you into a bad person. And so I think, at least in entrepreneurship in Islam, the way I see it is, if Allah gave you the ability to make a lot of money, then you also have the obligation to do it, but you also have the duty to give it back. And I see it as you have to kind of focus on yourself first and be able to build up that skill set and build up the abilities to establish a business, to hire people, to grow, to market, to expand, to build out the infrastructure, because you can't pour from an empty cup. You can't. As soon as a customer comes in, you give away all that money. You should have invested it back into your business. And there's steps along the way that you can, you know, this amount was going to go to my family. This amount's going to go to my parents. We're going to allocate this for a new home or a car or whatever. And along the way, and I've just noticed that even before I started making money, I've always donated. And I feel like wealthy people, or even people that are aspiring to be wealthy, sometimes think that you have to make a certain amount of money before you can start giving it back.
No, you give, I don't think that happens. You give what you can.
You just wake up one day and say, I'm going to start donating today because I finally hit this financial goal. Mm. I think if you get in the habit of just giving a little bit away at a time, whether it's a weekly or a monthly or annual thing, because you can never go broke from donating, because you're giving something that you already have. It's not like you're giving away something that you don't have. You don't go in debt to do it, to give a donation. It defeats the whole purpose. But I do want to ask you a little bit about, at least in this community in Atlanta, and entrepreneurs and business people, Muslim business people here, what do you think we should be doing to encourage and grow our communities and to elevate the young Muslims? Because I felt bad buying like my exotic car. Like I thought like I don't deserve it. I shouldn't do this. But then I see like all these young Muslim kids. One of them came at a car show a couple of days ago. He actually became Hafiz, memorized the whole Quran. He's like, yeah, I remember when you used to go to Masjid al-Farooq. And I'm like, yeah, I remember. I put you on Instagram. I asked you to recite. I just picked a random surah and you recited it. And now it's like, I see them 4 years later. They've memorized the entire Quran. They're like, oh yeah, I remember you. Like, man, how do I do this? How do I accomplish this? And I feel like it's okay. Like, it's okay to buy nice things and to treat with it, you know?
Yeah, I'll give you a testament to that. Is Imam Malik used to dress very nice. And people would ask him, you know, scholars and dress them very nice, should he be like, you know, Muhammad. He'll say that I want people to see the effect of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's near behind. If you can afford it, you can afford it. If it's something that it's haram, it's not haram for you to buy a nice car or for you to live within your means, and if your means are vast, then alhamdulillah. But one thing, so just to answer your question about entrepreneurs and what they can do, is they can be a little more strategic in their zakat and mad.
Okay.
Zakat and mad is the 2.5% that you must pay over your assets. Revolutionize it how? Instead of being lazy or looking at it as a tax that you're just paying on a yearly basis, scrap that. instead of just like going online trying to find a place to charity, all right, I got to get it out of the way, boom, call it a day. Understand the nature of zakat. What is the nature of zakat, and how can it be used, and how can it really change the game? If you were able to communicate with 5 to 10 people of your tax bracket and say, listen, I owe in my zakat 10K or 2.5K or however much, right? That's my 2.5%. And you owe 5K and you owe this much. Let's put it all together. It comes out to like 50K. And that 50K, you can give it in increments, or you can hold it until you find somebody in need or whatever it may be. Somebody that you know in the community struggling was just laid off. Take that 50K. Here's 50K. Let's start a business together. Give it 5 years and you stay in connection and help him out, you know, guide him, this and that. Now he is as a guide. Now instead of 10 people, it's 11. Or for example, you do 2, it's 12. Then by the time you reach a certain point, more people are giving zakat within your community, within your locality.
I see.
So you size your locality, grow your economic status, and then you'll start to sprout and do a lot more.
So you're saying don't use zakat as, or don't treat zakat as a tax. Like, I have to pay this and I'm obligated to, so let me just find any sort of organization online to pay and move forward. Instead, use it as an opportunity to effectuate change with people that may not have the financial means, and to teach them and empower them to be zakat givers next go around.
Exactly.
Because probably the worst thing you can do to someone that's in need, it's like, you know, you teach someone to fish is way better than just giving them the fish, you know? And
yeah, I mean, there are situations, I mean, you can portion it. So some people have medical emergencies, whatever.
Of course, like, of course. But if there's, but I like where you're going with this, because it's like,
or for example, bail someone out of a mortgage.
Right.
Because of Vaden as a person who was overcome by debt. Let's say you know somebody, they have a mortgage. It's a haram mortgage. He needs to get out of it. Think of it this way. You bail him out of that mortgage. He's got that last burst. Now all of a sudden, he doesn't have to pay that amount on a monthly basis.
Guess who's going to be giving zakat next?
Inshallah.
You know what I mean?
So use zakat as an opportunity to effectuate change and to grow members in the community. And for the people that need it, obviously give it to them. It's an obligation, but treat it as an opportunity versus a liability.
Exactly.
Beautiful. You got any other questions for me?
No, I mean,
I've been questioning you also. I've been asking you so many questions.
I've been bombarded here. Usually,
we can flip the script a little bit if you have any questions.
We'll have to do a second session for that one. So we have Maghrib in about
10 minutes, inshallah.
But I do want to ask you as a lawyer.
Okay. Right?
Uh-oh.
This is not legal.
How
advice.
Do you have any balance between your Muslim life and being a lawyer? And do you feel that sometimes you're kind of like looking at two different worlds? And how do you merge that, or how do you manage that disparity or difference?
I don't see them as different worlds at all. I see them very consistent. I'm a personal injury attorney, so I don't see a discrepancy or any sort of disagreement between Islamic values and my civil duties as a personal injury attorney. It'd be different if I was a criminal defense attorney and I was representing criminals that I knew were committing crimes that I should not be representing them for.
Corporate law or something.
Protecting, but yeah, now I'm on the opposite end where it's a consumer activism and consumer civil justice protector, because I help people in insurance claims, because these are these multi-billion dollar conglomerates that are charging you for a service and hoping that you never need it. And then when you do need it, they're going to figure out ways to pay you as little as possible. The only thing I would prop that I evaluate is the amount of time that I spend working. And sometimes it's overwhelming, at least for a business owner. I don't think most lawyers work as much as I do. But I think as a business owner, you're going to have to put in 70, 80, 90, 100-hour work weeks.
There's no time off for me.
So you're a lawyer and an entrepreneur.
I'm an entrepreneur that happens to be a lawyer.
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah. And it didn't matter what career path I would have taken. I was going to be a business person.
Mashallah.
But alhamdulillah, but I also don't take time off. Like I
I can't go and take like, you know, a week, 2 weeks off and completely disconnect.
Mm.
I'll travel, I'll go. But even on my honeymoon, I was taking calls and signing clients up. That's just how it is. And, you know, there's almost like a deep love for the game of entrepreneurship. But now, as, you know, a husband and a father, I am trying to buy back some of that time. And even when before I started this journey, I knew that I was buying time for the future. I knew that everything that I'm building and working towards right now is so that I could buy time with my kids in the future. And now that that debt is coming up due, I have to pay it. So I've been a little bit more strategic with my time. I've been trying to spend less time working, and that actually forces me to become more efficient. So I can delegate tasks more. And it kind of just boils down to paying people a little bit more and hiring more people. So I have like 60 employees now, and I pay everyone very well. They all have great benefits. They get to work from home. But there's also like accountability. You know, I see it as like professional athletes need coaches. You know, the president of the United States has an advisory board. What makes you think that you don't need any sort of accountability or coaching as an employee or as an entrepreneur or as a business owner? So I take care of my people, but I also hold them accountable. And if they don't meet the criteria and we give them multiple opportunities, then you better believe there's someone else that would love to have this chance to work.
I like it. It's a good balance, mashallah.
I love it. I love being a business owner. I love being able to help people, especially my team, because I want them to grow and I want them to succeed. And not everyone is cut out for running a business. Not everyone wants all that stress. I think the amount of money that you make is directly proportional to the amount of stress you're willing to take. If I could take stress off of your hands and ease your mind and ease your burden, and I can do that at scale, I'm worth a lot of money. But if you just want to solve tasks, and that's all you want to do, because your primary focus is, well, I just want to be able to stay home with my kids and tutor them, or I want to be able to coach, you know, basketball with the kids, or whatever. If that's what makes you happy and that's what you want to do, that's great. But, you know, I've always said, I'm not the guy that goes out and plants the trees when people need it. I'm not the guy that goes and builds the shelter. I'm the guy that makes tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars and donates that money so that we can assemble the entire army to build it, or the entire army to plant those trees. It took me a while to accept that my time is just more valuable being able to donate, right? But then there's also this concept that you start becoming detached, you know, when all you're doing is just giving money.
And that's why you should probably spend a little bit of time in the trenches, as it.
So I
to kind of realign that scope.
I agree with you. And I think that the Zakat point that you made, I think that's maybe this year what I'll do is I'll actually, instead of just donating, I'll go and buy things and actually pass them out myself to experience it as well and use that as an opportunity and maybe could make some connections and meet people. I went recently, there was this nonprofit organization that sends kids with disabilities to Disney World. And, you always wonder, what if your kid ends up having a disability, and it's not going to change the amount that you love them. It'll change your life in terms of the amount of time that you can dedicate to everyone and everything else that you have, because this one kid is going to need special treatment. That's why they're kids with special needs. And I had the opportunity to help and send, these two beautiful girls to Disney World, because they have their own sort of plane thing to go on, their own bus to transport them. And, you know, some of the money went towards home renovation so that they could actually, push the wheelchair through. One girl that was blind and had brittle bone syndrome. So, I mean, and I also noticed that, all the kids with special needs had a book where they can get signatures from all the Disney World characters. And then they specifically went out of their way to create a book in Braille for this one girl so that she could also experience the Disney World characters. And, the signatures are written in such a way where she could feel the signatures on this special book. And, it puts things into perspective, because honestly, at some point, business is just numbers, and you just kind of look at the numbers and say, well, let's just restructure this and change this. And it doesn't even feel real. But then when you take a little bit of it and you put it towards someone else's life and see how much it impacts them, it greatly increases your gratitude. And I think you're just sincerity with what you've been blessed with. So I 100% agree with you that entrepreneurs and business owners, and especially wealthy people, should be more involved in their charity and giving instead of just on the back end. Maybe I'll start doing that a little bit more. Inshallah.
May Allah reward you.
Make your scales of deeds heavy on the day of judgment.
Inshallah.
And make that charity a shafa'ah for you.
Good deeds, right?
Your good deeds. Suckers. Of course.
You said your scale of deeds. I'm like,
it goes without saying.
Sending this dua, FedEx delivery. I just want to make sure it's good deeds.
Oh, man. May Allah bless you.
So it looks like I was on your show, but it's kind of like this weird setup.
No. Okay. So look, we can do next time. You can interview me and ask me some questions, but I think this was very beneficial for the audience. And so guys, thank you so much for joining us for the CEO Lawyer podcast. Today we went in a completely total different direction, but it was still
a podcast too. I'm uploading on my channel as well.
All right.
The theme of our show is always it's
law, life, and business. And this one was all about life and a little bit of law mixed in. And then maybe at the end, a little bit of business. So thank you, Sheikh Ibrahim, for joining us today.
Habibi.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for